Welcome back to FinTech Family Hour, folks. This is Zach Anderson Pettit, Content Director at Money 2020 by day, your host by night. Our guest this week is Trevor Tanifam, principal at a brand you may recognize if you're a long-time or even medium-time listener of this show, FS Vector. We talk about a piece he recently penned about Bass in This Week in FinTech, and we even get a little crazy by talking about subjects outside of banking as a service. Woo! This episode is brought to you by Skipify. Without further ado, here's Trevor.
Tell me which bit is interesting and we can dive in. Perfect. So, Cameroonian born, British raised.
Okay.
American educated.
How old were you when you moved from Cameroon?
I was 4.
Okay. Okay. So, any additional languages or straight English?
So, French is in there.
Ah, vraiment?
Wait, bien sûr.
Ah, je savais pas.
Where did you pick up French?
So,
certainly not Kansas City.
Pourquoi pas? C'est facile de prendre. It's easy to figure this out in Kansas City. So actually, yes, Kansas City is where I learned French in a very, very bizarre set of circumstances. So I grew up in a neighborhood that wasn't super awesome. And like the way to get me out of that neighborhood was basically a charter school that was French immersion.
Okay.
So I ended up having like Senegalese, Cameroonian teachers through like a lot, like K through 8, basically. I like mostly had African teachers just because of the way that things were working at that point. And I think, second grade through 8th, it was full French immersion. And then high school, I just kind of like lost it a little bit. But I have family in France.
Yeah.
So I go there a couple times a year and have been able to like keep it a little bit, but I'm a lot more comfortable with an African dialect than I am with like a French dialect, or like a Parisian dialect.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of like how I grew up and having French, having African math teachers and things like that.
Have you spent any time in West Africa?
Zero, but I'm dying to go. Senegal is the place I think I want to go first, just because I've had like 7 teachers from there or something, and they hated me, and I not across the board, like 6 of 7 hated me because I was just like classic American white kid.
That's
like,
high.
You know, wasn't super excited to be at school. And I want to learn more about the culture and spend some time there.
Fair enough. Yeah. So, you know, moved from Cameroon to Southwest England, just outside of Southampton.
Okay. Southampton fan?
I used to be.
Okay.
And then they got relegated. And I could not watch championship football.
So you're a fair weather fan, or just like it hurt you so much that you had to stop watching it, or it was just the championship.
I like the pain aspect. Let's go with that. It was a pain of watching my team be relegated. But they got relegated basically the same year that a young Portuguese striker by the name of Cristiano Ronaldo moved to United. And I thought, oh, he looks...
Not a bad time to switch allegiances.
Yeah, so I switched right before then. And I've since been a United fan.
Do you get a lot of shit for that around Southampton or...
I don't really go back to Southampton, so...
It's probably a fair decision. So, I don't know anything about Southampton, but that's fair.
So no, but I'm sure if I did, I would. No, these days, when I get back to UK, mostly in and around London, my parents have since left the UK. They no longer live there. They never really quite lived there because they were both diplomats. They both worked for the UN.
Oh, fast. You've told me this before, I think.
Yeah, and so pretty much after being in UK for about 5 to 6 years, I've got an older brother and a younger sister. We all went to boarding school and my parents started traveling for work, and that just never stopped till this day. They're still running around.
Where are they now? Just like all over the place, different places, or like every few years kind of change?
So my dad is now retired. So now he follows mom around.
It's not a bad gig.
Not a bad gig at all. I'm interested in this job, but they're currently in Nigeria. That's where my mom works.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So that sounds like they've done a lot of moving around. Like by accident, have you seen a lot of the world because of that too?
I think so. So the major stints were, so my dad spent 8 years in Tanzania.
Wow.
And then 5 in Kenya. So those were the major spots, but mom moved around a lot more frequently. And so they also didn't move together. They moved separately from each other. So mom was in Switzerland, mom was in Ethiopia, mom was in Nigeria before, mom was in Uganda. She was in Atlanta, Georgia for a bit. And so home is basically wherever one of my parents were when, you know, Christmas or summer rolled around.
Sounds like you might just have a global perspective as a result of this a little bit.
One might say. I'm sure there's an anecdote here about how I bring it into my work, but I don't at all.
I mean, we'll get there. If anything, I'll fit a round peg in a square hole later and come up with some kind of metaphor or something like that for you.
Yeah.
We'll turn that corner at some point. So how did you get into the world that you're in now? And tell us, I mean, FS Vector was a sponsor and will for always be a friend of the podcast. So I suppose folks that are listening probably have some idea, but tell us like how you got to where you are a little bit professionally. And then what is this FS Vector thing? Just to remind folks.
Yeah, I suppose accidentally, like most people, I think I studied law in the US. It's why I moved over here. So I went to school down in DC and was always interested in sort of what I would describe as general corporate work.
You wanted to do business stuff.
I wanted to do business stuff. You know, I turned on a TV, I saw business things happening and I thought that looks nice. How do I get a piece of that action? And someone said, be a lawyer. And so I said, okay. Still waiting to figure out if a law degree is how you do business stuff, but I've still got time. And so studied law in DC, and then naturally being in DC, kind of got sucked into the world of regulatory work. And because I was interested in financial services regulation was sort of like an easy entry point. And so I kicked off at the CFTC, which is the principal federal derivatives regulator.
Started with the sexiness.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then went from there to FINRA, which is securities, SRO. And at that point, I then moved to New York and then kind of got into the consulting world. So Promontory Financial Group, which is now part of IBM.
Yeah, Promontory is a fascinating thing because like my introduction to Promontory, I was at NBKC doing community banky things. And my understanding of Promontory was that it was really just like a deposit sweep network. It's like, I mean, I guess that's a piece of what it does, but it's so much more than that, right?
Yeah. Gene Ludwig, who is a former comptroller of the currency, may work harder than Simon Taylor.
Ooh,
yeah, it's a big claim.
For listeners, we were talking about Simon before we started recording. I'm starting to feel like listeners are thinking I have a Simon Taylor crush because I feel like he comes up a lot in these just like random moments. I just use him as this like hardworking like thing on a hill that I look up to sort of thing.
Simon is a benchmark for all positive things.
Exactly. Anyway, yeah. Simon, I love you, but you know, don't take it. Relax.
Yeah. Well, so Gene created Promontory off the back of the financial crisis. And it was sort of a consulting firm built to help banks navigate that kind of post-08 world. And then as that work kind of finished, it sort of evolved into sort of an adult consulting firm that became kind of a broader, risk management compliance. Yeah, exactly. It, you know, had a very narrow focus and then that finished. And then we started doing kind of all sorts of consulting. And then ultimately sold to IBM, I think, in 2015.
So one thing I've always wondered, how does that acquisition make sense? Like, either do I not understand the world of consulting or do I not understand the world of IBM? Or like, how do these two things fit together? Because I've always, like, I know this story, but I've always wondered why. And I don't know if I've ever been in a situation to ask why.
I am happy to share with you what I was told.
Okay, I like that.
About why it like made that. Sense. So one, IBM is, you know, sort of the ultimate buyer, right? The list of acquisitions is in the hundreds, I think. And at the time, IBM sort of had this theory that they could train what was then Watson into being this sort of regulatory compliance machine. And so the idea was you would acquire a consulting firm that had the knowledge, the expertise, the capabilities around regulation, have that over time feed into kind of the IBM machine such that Watson would be this sort of deployable, like all regulatory machine.
At what point, do you know any idea what year that was?
So this is probably 2014, I think, maybe the conversation started happening.
Okay.
I think the deal was ultimately consummated in 2016.
Okay. Well, we'll start with that's interesting. And then I think we'll go to, followed by whoops.
It's New York FinTech Week, folks. Over 7,000 of FinTech's finest are planning, training, and automobiling to the city for New York's yearly FinTech gathering. Skippify is not only a partner with us here at FinTech Family Hour, but the team is also taking a big step even deeper into the FinTech community in New York this year by sponsoring Empire Startups, the flagship conference of New York FinTech Week. The conference is on April 10th. Rith Martin, Skippify's CEO, will be keynoting alongside Visa and another friend of the show that you may know, the one and only Emmeline Shaw of Flourish Ventures. They'll be taking the stage at 9:45 a.m. on Wednesday, April 10th. Be there. Come say hi to myself and the Skippify team. We will all be around.
Like, it makes a lot of sense, I guess, to some degree in terms of the theory. But also at the end of the day, I feel like the issue with this has always been, how are you going to build AI-oriented regulatory software that is inherently a black box? Like, how do you, like, if it was decision-making oriented, how is there ever going to be an explanation for the decision being made?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably several versions of this. So in its simplest forms, one of the ideas that Promontory had been working on that I think they were trying to bring into IBM was this idea of an obligations inventory. And so in its perfectly executed form, you take all regulations in a geography. So let's say the US, you take all of the guidance and you come up with a system that can map every piece of regulation through to guidance, through to a financial institution, through to a control, such that if a new piece of guidance comes out, you have this machine that can ingest that and basically say, push this button, change this thing, and that's how you then comply.
Okay.
But of course, that's not how regulation works.
No, not even in the slight. I mean, we'll get to all the nuance associated with the blog post that you have coming out, or the essay, or whatever we're calling it these days, but no, that's not how it works. And it seems like all of the decision making is in the nuance and in the gray area and in the conversation. Like, I guess it wouldn't be the first time that a technology company purchased a company in a highly regulated industry to try to attempt something that was highly regulated that they didn't quite understand. And then we get there and then we move on.
Correct. I think that is a whole investment thesis.
Yeah. Buying things that we don't understand.
Very much so. Very much so.
I think that's actually quite fair. It was quite fair, especially not that we would look at anything going on in AI right now and say that people are doing things that they don't understand out of sheer hype. That wouldn't be a correlation we draw at all.
No, not at all. I was waiting to hear how you're incorporating AI into your work. Aren't we all supposed to be?
Into my work? Kelsey, who's standing behind the camera right now, does a lot for me, and we do a lot together on ChatGPT to save ourselves time, but that's probably about it. It's a very underwhelming, yeah.
So Kelsey is your artificial intelligence.
Kelsey is my artificial. Yeah, Kelsey's actually not a human behind the camera. She's an artificial intelligence that we've renamed and is very capable of certain things. I don't even know where I was going to go with that, but it's a very pink artificial intelligence. If you could see the camera the other direction, you would understand why. Anyway.
I get it.
Okay, so makes sense. Is there any overlap between FS Vector and Promontory? I guess like getting to that spot, I suppose Promontory built some technology and things like that. It's maybe a bit different, but
only the drove of former Promontarians that now work at FS Vector.
Hold on, Promontarians.
Yeah.
That sounds so good with your accent. Promontarians coming out of your mouth is not a bad thing.
It's a real thing.
I like it.
It's a real thing. There is a Promontory mafia. Not spoken about nearly as
not the same as the PayPal mafia.
No. But we're working towards it. We're working towards it. So myself, Brian Mulcahy, who's the managing partner of the advisory group, Jasper Snefnani, also from Promontory, Christopher Seidler, who's a partner of FS Vector. So there's a lot of us. And Raj Date, who is one of the co-founders of FS Vector.
The man, the legend.
The man, the legend. Previously sold a business to Gene when Gene was at Promontory. So we're all familiar with each other.
Ain't fintech / financial services technology / financial services / technology, isn't it just the biggest, smallest world? Like, it's so funny how like gigantic it is, and like thousands of people descend on Money 2020 or whatever it is, but you end up just like, oh yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah.
It's never fails. It's so funny.
Yeah, yeah. I like that about it. I like that about it. It hopefully, I think, means, you know, you're never more than one or two emails away from kind of good information and from good perspective, which I think always helps.
1,000,000%. And that's what brings us here, just an email away. So coming to FS Vector, tell us, I guess, like a little bit high level again about kind of what the company is, and then specifically your work and kind of how that's changed even since your time there.
High level. FS Vector is a consulting firm. If you were to walk into the office in DC and looked around and observe for 2 minutes, you would go, ah, consulting firm, right? These people, they look like consultants. They behave like consultants. They act like consultants. They are consulting.
Fair.
But I think what makes FS Vector slightly different, at least I hope so, is that we're sort of a product consulting firm. And by that, I mean, everything we do is designed to help our clients get to market. And that's slightly different from other types of professional services companies that are kind of focused on, let's say, answering particular questions, solving for kind of narrow issues. What we're trying to do is just help you get to market, help you build a new product, help you scale. And that could involve focusing on very narrow, very sort of discrete questions. It could be very high level strategy, but always kind of pointed towards what is the next thing the business needs to achieve and how we can help them solve that.
So since FS Vector was a sponsor, I won't go too deep into this, but your work specifically, I think, has been interesting and like has actually, if I remember correctly, changed a decent amount, and you've covered a lot of different things since joining. So what are you specifically focused on inside of that?
It's definitely changed. I think one thing to keep in mind is that FS Vector is itself a startup. It is a 6-year-old firm. I've been there for 4 years. And as you know, fintech has changed dramatically in the last 5 to 6 years. And so at each point, we have constantly have to sort of reinvent ourselves and reinvent our services. And so when I first moved to FS Vector, it was just building compliance programs, right? That was the thing. It was policies and procedures drafting. It was right-sizing compliance programs for fintech companies who were partnering with banks. And then it sort of moved to kind of the banking as a service world. And then we were helping clients sort of figure out how to navigate and distinguish between all these different models and mm-hmm. which ones fit their products. And then kind of, I think, parallel to all of that was sort of the world of licensing and registration, because you'd always come up with companies who sort of wanted to do it themselves, right? They had a particular product that they didn't want to, or they wanted to build it the way they wanted to build it.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they didn't want a bank or a partner kind of telling them what to do with the, you know, with the AML program, with the complaints program, and they wanted to.
Now it sounds like you're talking like a crypto startup that you're working with, but anyway. Yeah,
exactly. But well, that's another big change, right? There was like, I think 2020 was the wave of crypto companies.
Yeah.
I mean, we had an incredible number of, clients that were in the digital asset space. And now we have kind of a small handful. So the firm has changed. But I think these days, the thing I spend most of my time doing is kind of advising banks that have gotten into
I don't know why that was so funny to me, but it's like the question mark. I guess I just work with banks now. Fuck.
Well, yeah. I got into fintech to work with banks.
Whoops. Yeah. It's like, shit, how'd I get here? I was having so much fun.
Yeah, it turns out everything leads to banks. And
it actually is it's like kind of a lesson in this industry, isn't it? Like at the end of the day, it all, like everything leads back to the chartered financial institution that you're working with that is regulated, right?
Yeah. And unfortunately, people are sort of learning that the hard way right now.
Yeah.
But it is very much the case, right? I've always been saying, if you are offering a product or service that relies on a regulated financial institution, that is your key stakeholder. That is the existential risk to your business. That is the place where your eyes and ears should be focused. And I think fintech sort of forgot that. We can, debate whether that's appropriate, right? Should we kind of work to a system where that is less the case. But as of now, I think it's very much the case.
And I mean, what's the argument for that not making sense? Like, what's the argument for like a regulated financial institution that is required to maintain safety and soundness and has multitudes of prudential regulators overseeing them? What's the argument for them not being compliant, taking the step? Like, I get the whole like crypto angle on this, I guess, right? The libertarian side of it. I like see it in some kind of 2 + 2, like almost equals 4 sort of way. Like, I get the logic, but then I actually think it through and I think about safety and soundness in the financial industry. And I'm like, no, I think we should like be compliant and just do, you know, we should do the things that we should have always done. And I don't really get the other side of it. Like, I don't understand this angle of, well, let's forget the BSA rules. Let's forget, you know, and not that anybody's really saying that, but it sometimes feels like this very convoluted, like the essay that we'll get to, right? Like, you had to write that many words. And then there was an essay that you had written previously that had a lot more words. And if you extrapolate a lot of that up, there's a number of takeaways. But one of the big ones is maintain compliance and make sure that you're having that conversation with your banking partner to understand what compliance means in terms of the spirit of it and the like rule of the letter of the law sort of thing. And that's pretty straightforward.
Some of this is profoundly straightforward.
Yeah.
It is profoundly straightforward. I think to kind of answer your question around, you know, who would disagree, I think some of the common conceptions are that it is difficult to innovate when you are tethered to a bank or a bank charter, because innovation, it is said, requires you to move fast and break things, and bank notoriously move slowly and sometimes break themselves, but you know, generally in the innovation sense, don't go out of their way to break things.
I mean, I get it. Again, I get it, but it sounds like a kid that just had a gigantic tub of ice cream and it's like, I want a second tub of ice cream, and I don't want the logic of my stomach hurting. You know, like, okay, if you want to innovate in financial services, like, you have to do it in a safe and sound manner, or you have to do it around the periphery where you don't have to necessarily touch that institution, right? Like, run with some fake data, prove some shit, and then like move in. But you shouldn't be able to Facebook around these parts. Like, that's my perspective, at least. I don't know.
I think I agree. And part of the reason I have this bias is because, again, I think these rules fundamentally are straightforward. I think part of the issue that certain segments of the industry have gotten themselves into is that they have tried to innovate by abstraction. Right. And so they're trying to take away things to make it quicker, to make it faster, to make it cheaper. And, you know, quicker, faster, cheaper it sells very easily, but you can sort of take it too far. And I think that's where, particularly in sort of the banking as a service space, I think that's where a lot of these companies have found themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that I was at it's not any secrets on my LinkedIn that I was at a banking as a service company before I joined Money 2020. And one of the most interesting parts about that experience was how much the goal was just to decrease time to market. It wasn't even really to decrease complexity or anything like that in my experience. It was just like, how do we get days out of this, even if we don't necessarily have the most logical output or even a compliant output? It's just, we want to get you, you know, to market, and we want you to be able to create an instance in 5 minutes. And this argument of like, the same way you spin up an AWS server, you should be able to spin up a, you know, banking as a service instance or something like that. It's just, I think the barrier to entry increasing is a good thing, I guess, is my takeaway. Like, it just feels safer, sounder. I'm going to say this is a safety and soundness drinking game is what this is today.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a good thing in the short term, just so everyone can, you know, catch your breaths, be reminded about how things are supposed to work and redevelop some of those good habits. I do think that as more banks re-realize what the obligations are, as they, you know, stop getting, I suppose, drunk on the illusion of quick and easy deposits, I think there's a ton of innovation out there that can work. And there are banks doing this. You know, there are banks that, you know, one of the things I reference in the article is, which, you know, is kind of built around this idea that there are certain banking as a service models that are good and others that are bad. and regulators like the good ones and hate the bad ones. And I sort of point out a handful of things, one of which is that many banks with many different models have survived supervisory examinations. And the only thing that ties all of those banks together is that they were operating in a compliant manner.
Yep.
Right. There is no such thing as a business model the regulators have preference for, right? They show up there with an examination manual that lists the bank's responsibilities and they go down the list. If you are executing all of those, you survive. If you are missing on a handful of those, then you do poorly. And whether you are doing it directly, i.e. by yourself, or through one party, or three parties, or 10 parties, regulators have no, they don't have an opinion on how many technology layers should be involved right. in the delivery of a service.
And they're not going to tell you one company versus the other. I think that's the funniest part about a lot of this is, this is kind of jumping to a different question I was planning to ask you kind of at the end of this, but I actually think it's one of the more interesting questions in this that I keep asking myself. So we talk about banking as a service and we talk about this model and truly direct versus indirect versus direct. And I want to go there in a minute and kind of talk about the nuances.
This episode is brought to you by Skipify. So what is this magical Skipify, this connected wallet thing that they've built? Well, imagine purchasing a product as a consumer with a merchant you've never actually shopped with before, and your credit card's already saved with them. Sounds scary, but it's not. You've never added this merchant before. Your shipping address is already there. How did they know? You're not sure, but you hit buy and your product is on the way. That's Skipify in the background. Skipify goes beyond what other digital wallets or one-click checkout products are doing. They've built direct integrations within the banks you already bank with. That's where the connected piece of the connected wallet comes from. So that step of adding or saving cards in the connected wallet is totally skipped. Get it? Skipify. Skipify is pre-populating card info and shipping details from the banks for consumers. They can even embed features like card offers, paying with points, or buy now, pay later options directly into the moment of checkout. It's better for the banks than Apple Pay, better conversion for the merchants, and better consumer experience for the actual shopper. If you aren't working with Skipify yet, you probably should be, or at the very least, go check them out. Go to Skipify.com to learn more, set up a demo, and don't forget to come say hi at Empire Startups on April 10th. Tickets are still available.
But sometimes I wonder in banking as a service and embedded finance, how much are we solving, like, I don't even know if it's right to think of it in terms of like a local or a global maxima, but how fucking big is this market? And does it matter as much as we give it credence, right? Like, we obsess on banking as a service, we obsess on embedded finance, we talk like Alex and like Jason McCool is getting in fights on Twitter about it with like different people. I mean, it's just like it's gotten to a point where I'm kind of wondering if the amount of time that we spend focused on this thing actually mirrors the market opportunity and mirrors the actual impact that it has or could have, right? Granted, there was the whole, like, you know, at one point Chime would be like an embedded finance user or something like that. So there was a time when we were thinking about like arming the neobanks, and that made sense maybe to some degree in terms of the TAM and in terms of the obsession. But now that we've seen probably the direction that those are going, and we're thinking about how, you know, how do we get a debit card to Nike? How do we get a debit card to Etsy? You know, those kinds of things. Like, I just keep coming back to like, are we focused on the right things? And is this actually the thing that we should all be obsessing about writing? And I, for the record, I really did like what you wrote, but I get into Twitter and I'm like, oh my God, is there anything else in fintech? Like, are we talking about, I don't even know what that's, I mean, open banking, like it's like, we, you know, the open banking rules coming later this year. And I see so much more about, well, consent order from this group. And I guess if it bleeds, it leads, and consent orders are like the, you know, shooting at the 6 o'clock news or something. Anyway, I've asked this question like 7 different times now, but as you can tell, some passion and curiosity and confusion.
It's a really interesting question. And here's my perspective. I think what a lot of investors and venture capitalists have realized is that, one, you know, non-consumer SaaS does much better than consumer-oriented businesses. You know, this is kind of, you know, Matt Harris at Bain always says, you know, he doesn't invest in consumer because it's sort of a, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think he calls it like a popularity contest, you know, and he's not in the business of picking what people like. And so I think, one, embedded finance makes a lot of sense from like a SaaS investment perspective. And the other thing that I think a lot of investors realize is that if you look at a lot of, you know, commercial businesses that have some sort of embedded finance, a lot of them end up making more money from processing payments or offering some sort of financial product or service than they do from their core business. And this is something we've seen a lot in, you know, I mean, we have customers that come in and say, hey, we're like a real estate, you know, like a rental management software company. And we go, great. And then, you know, they tell us that their core business that they charge a SaaS fee for, you know, made $12 million last year. And in payments and cards and whatever, they made like $50 million. And it's like, you're a payments company. Yeah. And that's become obvious. And so I think the market opportunity that investors have realized is, look at how many businesses are out there that if we can just decrease the barrier to entry into embedding some sort of financial product or service, then they can make more money and we can scale much easier that way. But I do agree with you that I think personally speaking, I don't think that this is kind of where we should be spending a lot of our biggest brains, right? There are a lot of big brains in this industry, and I think embedded finance is not a big brain area.
So what you wrote and what you said earlier about the simplicity, I suppose, of what we're talking about here, it does often feel like the mental models are there. The execution needs to happen inside of the banks. And the rest is kind of the bleeds it leads thing, right? Like most of the banks that are doing an amazing job of executing on this are not being discussed that often, in my experience.
Correct.
Because to your point, they're not getting consent orders, right? Like even when I was at MBKC, we went from 0 to 21 partnerships in 18 months. That was bonkers, right? And that was like in 2017, 18, 19. When the fuck was that? 18.
I think it's okay now to speak in terms of pre-COVID and post-COVID.
It was pre-COVID.
Yeah, there we go.
I've completely lost track of what my life was pre-COVID. Apparently, I lived like a couple decades before then, but all of I know.
Yeah.
So that was like during the early days of that, right? And like, I don't know our bank score. I'm not allowed to know a lot of things about that, but I do know we sure as shit weren't under any consent orders and we sure as shit weren't in a really tough place. I feel like there's always a little back and forth between a banker and a regulator, but came out of that in a really good spot and had, you know, decided to slow down maybe at some pieces just because that was the right thing to do for compliance. But to your point, that's just being a risk managing, compliance obsessed business, which really all banks should be, right?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And we at FS Vector have helped a handful of banks get into the banking as a service, partner banking space, right? Where they are working directly with fintechs. And part of the way we've often done it is one, slowly, and two, starting with kind of direct regulatory interaction. Because a lot of banks that get into this space just kind of start offering the product and service because they're a bank, they kind of broadly maybe know how this stuff works. And when you're planning to really invest in this area and scale very quickly, I would say that is ill-advised. You're much better off going to your potential regulator, particularly in this environment, and saying, we're trying to get into this. Here's how we think it's going to work. Here's the investments we're going to make. Here are the types of companies that we're going to work with. Here's how we're going to diligence them. Here's how we're going to onboard them. Here is how our compliance program will scale with the growth in our program. I saw a chart. It may have been a FedFi's chart, but as a compliance person, it was one of the best charts I've ever seen. And I think it was...
Trevor. Breathe, brother.
I'm readjusting myself in my seat. And I think it may have been CFSB, Community Federal Savings Bank. And it was a chart that showed the growth in compliance FTEs and compliance spend mapped against the growth in your partner banking program.
Yeah.
And that is the sort of chart you want to show an examiner on day one when they walk in, right? You go, yes, our fintech program has gone up and to the right. And yes, also our compliance and risk management investment has also gone up and to the right. And that's the sort of message you want to send. As opposed to what I think a lot of the middlewares are selling, which is you can grow your fintech program up and to the right while simultaneously decreasing cost and investment and compliance because we have technology that makes everything faster and cheaper. And that is a fundamentally bad message to be putting in front of a regulator.
So it is a fundamental, I totally agree on the putting in front of a regulator piece, but is it a bad message in general, or is it the right message to the market in terms of simplifying, increasing speed, like simplifying things? Like, I guess my larger question here that I'm actually drawing towards is, middleware currently solving the right problem? Like, are they focused on the right things? Even taking into account, like, you know, I was alluding to Jason's drama a little bit, but that drama came as a result of him giving a very interestingly phrased perspective on units pivot into direct, right? So I guess, what is the problem to be solved with these companies? Where should they be focused from your point of view?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that you start with the list of things that need to be done in order to offer a financial product and service. And then you figure out, if you're a technology provider, figure out the ways in which your technology can make those things easier to do and therefore easier to scale. And that, I think, is always a perspective you should take. Keeping in mind, like we mentioned earlier, that the bank is a regulated entity. And so it is not just enough that these things happen. They have to happen in a particular way. They have to be auditable. The bank needs to be able to point exactly to where things are happening and how they're happening, and need to be able to prove to an examiner that they have the ability to actually exercise control over these programs and test the execution of these compliance controls. And so to the extent that any sort of technology can make that easier, that is very much a welcomed addition, I think, to the world of financial services. And something I did mention in my article is that these banking as a service companies or platforms have done a whole lot for, I think, financial services, right? Because they've reoriented how we think about things like time to market. Mm-hmm. And now businesses know, and banks know, and consumers know that it is in fact possible to do things quickly. And so that now is the new normal. And I think the industry will demand that we continue to figure out a way, like after being able to, you know, after a company has experienced what it's like to go live with a bank in, you know, 7 weeks, they're not just going to go back to doing it in 8 months. Yeah. Right. And so we will, I think, still continue to push for, again, quicker, better, faster, quicker, better, cheaper, rather, but not at the cost of these very basic and fundamental rules.
Yeah. Taking a step back, it sounds like the right product market fit for banking as a service from the answer you just gave is reg tech or supervisory technology, one of the two. And it's funny to me how banking as a service companies that I've paid attention to have always had this like side alley, like, we're banking as a service, card issuance, yada, yada, you know, like here's a big dollar sign, come towards it. And then there's like the side alley that's like, we do compliance over here. You know, like we don't really talk about it, but like regulations on the side, you know, and it's like ketchup, yeah, or something like that. Just like a thing of fries, and like the steak is the money, right?
Yeah.
It seems like what you're saying is almost an inverse of, sure, there's money, but the bigger opportunity for these groups is to create auditable logs, to create seamless integration and communication between the different groups involved. Like, it sounds like supervisory or regulatory technology more than it sounds like a layer between a card issuer and a neobank or whatever it might be. Is that, am I reading those cards correctly?
I think so. The trouble with that, of course, is that it's hard.
Very.
It's very difficult.
And it's even harder to pull in all your favorite buzzwords. Like, sorry, it's hard to talk about AI when you're getting into reg tech. It's hard to talk about a lot of these different things.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that's definitely where an opportunity is. And look, companies that are planning on being around 10, 20 years from now will see the value in making that investment. There are a lot of banks, and there is tremendous growth opportunity in helping banks do things more effectively. And so I think theoretically I support this kind of pivot to helping the bank do something and therefore helping fintechs get to market.
Yeah.
Right. If you can help the bank's processes, by definition, you will make it easier for those banks to onboard other customers and companies and offer their products and services, as opposed to sort of trying to play matchmaker.
Dude, I think you just hit it on the head, right? Like going from being like, well, never mind. I was about to compare it to Tinder. I shouldn't go there. But going from being a...
This is your show, mate. This is your show. You take this where you want to go.
You know, still got a day job at this point. We're going from matchmaking into actually solving problems, right? Well, because I guess initially in the first wave of this, the matchmaking was the problem, right? Like for a community bank in Kansas City, I was basically hired to bring in deal flow because I knew startups and I knew I could like go meet startups, right? And there was an ability to bring in 50 to 100 new conversations in 6 months was the problem to solve at that point. And now we've gone from like, okay, the market's fucking huge. Now are we going to like, how are we going to digest this, I guess, is the next problem to solve. So I feel like a lot of times, especially now being out of banking as a service, like take this step back and look at it like a middle school principal or something. And I'm like, you fucking kids, you know, or something like that. But then if you think about the actual evolution of the market, these are some really smart people just skating to where the problem's going to be and skating to where the puck's going to be and solving the problem that will be there now and down the line. So I don't know, maybe I should be a little bit more open-minded about these things.
Yeah. And maybe it makes sense, right? I think, you know, selling into banks is notoriously hard.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, it is probably easier for a lot of these BaaS platforms that built their reputations, for those that still have good reputations, it is easier for them to now pivot and turn to banks and say, now you know who we are, now you know how we work, let's kind of discuss ways we can help you be more efficient. And I think we see a lot of early stage companies that are building tech for banks, and that's it's a very hard space to play in. Banks are notoriously, you know, the sales cycle is horrific, right? It is horrific. Even if you're just trying to offer like a professional service to a bank, right?
That's a man speaking from experience.
when you're trying to get a bank to adopt a new technology, I mean, years, right? Years. And so maybe these companies will have an easier time now being service providers to banks and embedding themselves into kind of the banking infrastructure. It remains to be seen, but there's no shortage of excitement in BaaS.
No shortage of excitement. And to your point, I think what you just described is the reason that I have put off starting a company for so long and probably will continue to put it off for an extended period of time until something in the fintech space makes so much sense that it just drives me off a cliff. Like watching, like being inside of a bank and then being on the other side and having been in and around fintech for like a decade, like I want to start a company one day. It's 1,000,000% the goal. But you get close to banks and you're like, wait, I just saw an entrepreneur spend 6 months trying to get a meeting, much less trying to get a dollar, trying to get like actual, you know, anything booked and get any revenue out of this. And granted, there's more of a moat and yada, yada, yada. Once you get there, like obviously, but the pain associated with 0 to 1 in this industry is so significant that it is the other thing that kind of like validates but makes me question the banking as a service world, because so many people are running after the same dollar. And I do wonder if, you know, Plaid quietly building the tooling for open banking or any of these other startups quietly build, well, maybe not quietly, but quieter to what we're talking about, building that tooling, like, are those the next big companies? And are we too obsessed with the mean girls, like high school drama a little bit? And should we be focusing elsewhere? I just keep coming back to that. And I know it matters. I know it's important and probably a little bit of my fact that I had to be at one of these companies for a period of time shows a little bit, because I'm just like, I am ready to talk about something else now. But yeah, there is no lack of drama. And I sometimes wonder if we obsess on the drama or the actual business use case.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can spend more time on the latter. I think one of the kind of adverse impacts of this is that potentially it drives the cost of entry way up for new companies.
Yeah.
Because if you can't, once you remove, again, this banking as a service platform that could get you onboarded with a bank quickly and cheaply, if you, for example, were to try and build that company today, you know, the amount of money you would have to raise just to be able to find a bank to offer that product and service would be enormous, right? You can no longer, you know, do a friends and family round, pull together 250K and get in market and start moving. You know, you can't go directly to a bank with $250,000 to offer a financial product.
Right. Oh, there's kind of two sides of that, right? Like one side, you want that barrier to entry to be low. But if you think about what it takes to actually start a bank, right? Like you shouldn't be able to raise 250K and start a bank, I don't think. And I don't think that's a world that we would ever want to exist. Like you want it to be well capitalized. You want to make sure that, you know, everything is in place, all the policies, procedures, you know, the compliance, all of that. Like thinking about the de novo banks that have been started, not that the same, I mean, inherently embedded finance / banking as a service would not exist if you were creating the same barrier to entry, but it seems like we've gone for, you know, the last few years to creating 1/500th of the barrier to entry or something like that, or like 1/1,000,000,000th. And we're moving now towards like 1/1,000th or something. And that feels fair. It feels like a very natural kind of evolution in the market.
Yeah. Well, the barrier to entry is kind of what created and kind of gave rise to, I think, these BaaS platforms.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Because there once upon a time, again, going way back to what FS Vectors looked like over the years, we used to get an enormous number of clients coming to us saying, we want to be a bank, we want to buy a bank, we want to charter de novo bank. And we would spend most of our time talking them out of it. And we almost always succeeded. There were kind of one or two that really wanted to, just because it made sense, because they had kind of former bankers on their teams. Yeah. and they're familiar with the process. And I think it's that difficulty of getting access to charters that has given rise to partner banking, which has then given rise to kind of the proliferation of the BaaS platforms. And when I was mentioning the cost earlier, I meant even more from like the fintech front. Right. So, you know, you and I want to create a financial product, consumer, commercial, doesn't matter. And we need a bank. You know, 3 years ago, we could raise 250K and get that product into market. Today, we cannot. And I think, you know, that sort of barrier to entry is maybe the thing that, you know, these BaaS platforms are trying to solve for, that hopefully kind of through iteration and scale and an optionality we can get back to, right? Because what will happen, I think, is a lot of banks are going to leave the banking and service, the partner banking space, because of the regulatory pressure. Those that stay in will invest. Those that are on the sidelines will invest. And then I suspect, you know, in a couple of years, we'll get back to a place where we have lots and lots of banks that are willing to operate in this area that have built the right way. And then kind of that competition will drive prices back down, which, you know, the opposite of which is currently happening as banks are exiting. The cost of these partnerships is skyrocketing.
So you're saying we're in like a microeconomic cycle, basically, and kind of we'll get back to like history will at least rhyme, if not repeat itself, pretty much?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. That's that would be my prediction. You know, I think 3 years from now, no one will be talking about this in the same way.
It's actually, so it's fascinating that you say that. One of the things that we are putting out in this story for Money 2020, so we write like we go in a hole for like 3 months and we write a story that is supposed to kind of mirror to some degree like the most interesting or meaningful things that are supposed to happen in fintech or financial services for the year. One of the things that we have been brainstorming and talking about that's kind of hard to phrase and that I'm trying to figure out how to, like what the steps to it are and like how to actually kind of encapsulate what I'm about to say. But I think that we've now been through one full, what I'm going to call fintechonomic cycle. Like, I think that we've seen rising rates, we've seen lowering rates, we've seen boom, we've seen bust from an, you know, macroeconomic perspective. And then in terms of like a technology perspective, I think we've seen at least one full turn in terms of what you were alluding to, right? In terms of like, okay, super low barrier to entry, we're going to build all this technology as a result of that, compliance swoops in, that shifts, now you need 5 million to be able to get to market now, you know, and then like, or if you even think about like the Plaids and the Stripes and just the inherent like, okay, they've reached a certain trajectory and either now go public or stay private or whatever, but eventually there's a liquidity event there. And all of these upstarts are now incumbents, right? Which I think is pretty interesting. So I don't know exactly the question. I'm just curious about your perspective on that. Like, does that ring true to you? Do you feel like we've been through a full economic and technological cycle as an industry? Or do we have like some things left to finish out?
I think that's a really interesting question. I've never given this any real thought.
That's why I like to ask it on the spot.
it sounds true. I do think that there are a couple of areas that kind of throughout the cycle have been missed or have not received as much attention. You know, one of the ones I would mention, for example, is consumer. I think the last cycle really focused on kind of commercial and non-consumer use cases in fintech, right? Everything was embedded. Everything was sort of SaaS. And when I first got into this space, the key talking point was like, disrupting the big banks, right? It was neobanking. It was about better products and services to consumers. And that hasn't really happened. I did see Robinhood launch some gold card yesterday.
Is that better for consumers, Trevor?
it's
sick. We launched a gold card with 3% cash back, bro. Go pick it up. You can fucking trade stocks in 2 seconds, man. Apparently. What a time to be alive.
Yeah, it's for someone. It's for someone.
It's for Reddit. It's for a kid in his basement that just got a credit score and he's not sure what to do with it.
You know,
sorry, I have obviously a lot of respect for Robinhood.
Yeah, like if Robinhood captures the Reddit crowd, they might do very well.
Because that went so well with the GameStop.
Touche. So, you know, I'm still waiting to see sort of real innovation and quote unquote disruption in consumer. And so I think that's kind of something that was not well accounted for in the last cycle. Something that I think potentially if AI is what they say it is, and I confess I don't know what AI is. I mean that sincerely.
You're not supposed to say that publicly, Trevor.
I've read many things.
I've read many things.
I continue to read things.
I'm able to,
I continue
explain.
To read things. but look, I don't understand it in the way that I like to understand things before I say I know them.
That's because you're a lawyer and there's not shit to, I mean, there's shit to understand, but there's not clarity there.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe I'm waiting for that moment of clarity to hit. But from what I do understand, that seems like, you know, something that could hopefully have really good, consumer use cases, right? Because consumer financial services, I think, is all about personalization. And that's something that, you know, the bulge bracket banks are very bad at because they're too big. And as you increase in scale, you kind of lose that ability. And so fintechs were supposed to pop up and, you know, like, and there was a wave of this, but it wasn't really, right? We had all the like neobank for carpenters and like credit cards for, you know, pick your kind of, pick your profession or industry. But, you know, that's not innovation. That's just a marketing wrapper. And so I think there is still an opportunity for really thoughtful consumer use cases.
I kind of wonder, I agree with what you're saying, but I kind of wonder if it's either starting to pop up or has existed and we just don't focus on it because we are thinking about the SoFis and the Chimes. And like, I feel like there's some legit innovation that like a Cash App has done, groups like that, you know, and like I think a lot of the innovation has accrued to the winners, right? Like a lot of like the, I mean, I don't know. Do we define 2 days?
I can see BNPL in the tip of your tongue.
I was actually going to say the 2 day early paycheck thing, like all the way back to that. Like, does that, I mean, I think that counts as business model innovation, but does it, and I think there's some technological piece to it, but it's innovation. And so I talked to the founder of a company called Charlie, the other day, and they're a neobank focused on 60 plus, focused on kind of the baby boomer generation. And they're building legitimate products for that generation that are not a reverse mortgage, right? That are not something you're going to hear at like 2 a.m. on Fox News after like a gold coin advert or something like that. Like, they're building things that exist for that market to solve problems that only exist in that market. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about Charlie. I mean, the CEO and co-founder was one of the founders of Oscar Health, like, legitimate guy. It kind of brings me back to this banking as a service thing of like, if it bleeds, it leads. Like, if it helps a retiree do something easier, it's not the sexiest story to tell, like, at the top of the hour, you know? And I wonder how much, like, Cash App being able to service a portion of the society that has not been serviced by JPM or B of A, or inherently, like, B of A doesn't want to touch, and Charlie doing something like, is there innovation happening and we're just not talking about it, and we're overstating how much everybody's obsessing on this side when a lot of good stuff is happening?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I think in that sense, you know, fintech is probably no different from any other industry, right? The if it bleeds, it leads. This is something that, you know, that is a function of life on Earth in 2024, probably more than it is a fintech specific thing. And so there is definitely some innovation out there, and things like Cash App should be applauded, because they've been around now for a long time. I think they're kind of creeping into incumbent territory, and that's a feat.
It's so cool. I mean, if you think about Cash App, Stripe, like Block in general, actually, like a lot of these companies are creeping into incumbent territory, like continuing to do really cool shit, continuing to move incredibly quickly. But like, one of the other things in that story that we're writing about is fintech growing up, and just this idea, like, we are out of adolescence, you know, like, it's time for us to be real adults. And I think that's the time. I think that's also, to me, why the banking as a service thing is, I was going to say infuriating. It's not infuriating. It's at times frustrating, because now we're over a decade into this in terms of like the true, like, fintech's a household, householdish kind of term. Like, how are we still at a point where, and I don't think this is actually what's happening really, but sometimes I feel like we're still at a point where we're trying to cut corners around specific things, or trying to like make this easier by just sneaking it through or something. I don't know. But it does feel like it's time for us to like grow up, and actually it's time for us to continue. Like, this to me actually feels like the right time to start a neobank again, ironically. Like, it feels like the worst time, and I think that's actually the right time. Like, I think this is the moment to build something that actually could challenge Chime, or challenge whoever, you know, even challenge JPM. I mean, Mercury's done it, fuck, like, it's doable. You know, I mean, the numbers are very different, but like, the growth trajectory is big enough that if you squint and look out far enough, it's kind of scary to JPM or something. I don't know. Love you, Ahmad.
Yeah, I think the issue you still run into is access to banking charters, at least in the US specifically.
Yeah.
Right. The ability to take on deposits and to have those low cost deposits be a source of funding is huge. Right. It's why US banks, by and large, do as well as they do kind of compared to banks in other jurisdictions. And so, you know, I think that if and when that gets easier, that will probably then be the time to jump back into sort of the bank charting space. A lot of that is, quite frankly, an administrative cycle. You know, we currently in DC, they're not so hot on fintechs. That could change, you know, in November of this year, and then kind of going into next year, or the year after, realistically, we see a change in dynamic.
Do you think fintech's a bipartisan issue? Like, do you think it's one where one side of the alley, or one side of things takes a different perspective than the other? Like, I feel like that's very much happened with crypto.
Crypto, definitely. Fintech, not so much.
Okay.
Fintech, not so much.
Good. Yeah. I was hoping you'd say no.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. That's certainly not the perspective we've gotten from kind of the advocacy side of the House of Reps vector that is very much ingrained in these issues. I do think that in some areas, certain parts of consumer fintechs can be bipartisan. But as a whole, I think the proliferation of like financial services being delivered using technology is something that is broadly supported.
That's good. Okay. I was going to say that you just described what I would hope would be a mutual agreement in the 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
Good. Good. All right, Trevor, I want to be respectful of your time, my friend. It's 9:40. I feel like you probably got to get out of here pretty quickly.
Yeah. I was here at 8:30. There was no breakfast.
I don't feed you the way I should, do I?
Future guests, take note. No breakfast was served.
There was no buffet when I walked in. This is bullshit. All right, man. Thank you for the time. We're going to have you back on. Clearly, we could talk for another couple hours.
This was a ton of fun. I appreciate it. Hey, thank you.
Appreciate you, my friend. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you're still listening, you're probably reaching for your phone to pick your next podcast or switch to music or just call it a day because you can't believe how much valuable information you just took in. But before you pick that next thing, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, and all that jazz. Generally, scream from the rafters about how much you love FinTech Family Hour. Thank you again to our sponsor, FS Vector. And until next time, stay healthy, keep your head high, your costs low, and I love you all.